At issue, socialism. Is there a difference between socialism and liberalism today? I am Denny Crimmins, associate publisher of Harper's Magazine, and with me today on At Issue is Michael Harrington, author of The Other America, chairman of the American Socialist Party, and working on a book entitled Towards a Democratic Left. Michael is a mainstay in the socialist movement in this country, as a recent visitor to the International in London, and also as a contributor to in the current issue of Harper's and a piece on the failure of socialism. What is in the current vernacular? Is there a difference between socialism and liberalism?
I think there's a very real difference. But first of all, I would say that there's a tremendous amount that the two currents of thought share. That is to say, socialists and liberals work together on all kinds of immediate reforms. And the attitude that one sometimes gets on the American left, that the liberals are a bunch of sellouts who must be avoided at all costs, is in American society, to my mind, a suicidal attitude, because that in effect means there won't be any reform and radicals will be out on the fringe of the society without relevance. Having said that, working with liberals, intending to work with liberals into the future, because I do not see the emergence of a mass socialist movement tomorrow morning in this society. Having said that, I still believe that there are very basic differences. Perhaps the most fundamental one is this. The liberal is convinced that working within the structure of a capitalist society, no matter how modified, still a capitalist society, an ameliorated, reformist, welfare state capitalist society, but a society in which wealth is systematically maldistributed, that working within the framework of such a society, it's possible to achieve a just social order through reform without attacking the basic fundamentals of the society, or the structure of the society. I believe, and socialists believe, that as long as you have that fundamental structure of inequality, every reform is going to be vitiated or subverted. For example, although most people don't know it, the money spent on public housing in the United States is about half the value of one tax deduction for the home building, middle class, and rich. In 1962, we spent about $865 million on public housing. And that tax deduction for the one-fifth top income recipients in this country was worth $1.5 billion. Or let me take an example from Europe, which is cited in my article in the current issue of Harper's. In Europe, when industry was nationalized, the main recipient of benefit from that nationalization, and I'm in favor of it, but the main recipient of benefits from it was private industry. That is to say, in England and in France and Austria, Italy, the nationalized electricity, transportation sectors of the economy and the other nationalized sectors provide very cheap and efficient materials for private industry. Gunnar Myrdal has even suggested that in India, reform and nationalization has benefited the profits of big business more than any other group.
And I think, as you point out in your piece, they also tend to nationalize the failing industries.
Right.
We're looking at our own railroads, which can't run here, for a case.
And I'm sure very soon American business is going to offer to sell to the nation passenger service while retaining for itself freight service. That is to say, they're going to try to sell the
nonprofit part of the business to the government.
But so what I'm saying then is as a fundamental difference is that a socialist understands that unless you attack that fundamental structure of inequality, unless you redistribute income, unless you actually change the shares in the society, reform is always going to have this somewhat counterproductive aspect. Secondly, I think socialists understand the sense in which now private investment by huge corporations having tremendous social consequences has become so social that it cannot be left to private decision-making. It is not a private matter that the automobile industry decides to maximize private automobile transportation and pollute the atmosphere so that it becomes unbreathable. Moreover, the very existence of that industry in private hands, with all of its concentrated wealth, also concentrates political power. And that's one of the reasons why that industry has persuaded the society to spend more than $50 billion on roads for those automobiles which it produces, while spending practically nothing on decent mass transportation in the United States. So secondly, the socialist says, not only do you have to restructure income inequality into income more like and more near income equality, but secondly, you have to socialize investment. The society has to play a role in making these decisions about investment, which are increasingly social.
I think you also point out, too, that technical power is controlled, and this is a very real thing both in Europe and in this country by private means. You gave several examples where companies have been nationalized, and the technicians leave, leaving, really destroying the heart of these companies.
Right, and I think that this is a point that Kenneth Galbraith has made, and Galbraith would consider himself a liberal, but I think his analyses have socialist implications, at least to my thinking. Galbraith calls these technicians the technostructure in his book, The New Industrial State, and he points out that the corporation, in a sense, is socializing itself, that what is now happening is the stockholder is more and more functionless. He really doesn't intervene in determining policy whatsoever. Even now, the money market is getting to be more and more irrelevant to these big corporations because Adolf Burley, in a recent book, computed that in 1964, retained profits allowed the corporations to have a $59 billion investment fund. So now you're getting these corporations, which are self-financing, self-perpetuating organizations run by experts, not really responsive to stockholders. And at that point, I think the whole mythology of private enterprise, in which the theory was because a man took risks with his money, he got the right to make the decision. Mm-hmm. That mythology is simply being shattered already in front of us. And where I differ from Galbraith is that I am for, in a much more rapid fashion, readjusting our institutions and political structures so that they conform to the economic reality which he described.
I think one interesting thing that struck me in your piece is that you talk about the attitude towards money playing a very active role in this, particularly amongst the young in this country. The Fortune survey, I think you quoted, which the large percentage of college students or the under 25 populace doesn't want necessarily a large income. It doesn't seek a large income.
Well, actually, I think that that's probably one of the main sources of hope, that it's possible politically to envision radical social change in the future. If one simply counts on the old Marxist thesis that the working class is going to become larger and larger and more militant and militant as a result of the evolution of capitalist society, it's clear that that's not happening. The working class as a relative percentage of the society is declining, although it remains a huge source of political power. Even in a country like France, where the workers went on a general strike in May of 1968, their demands were not for revolution, but essentially for wages and more rights at the point of production. Therefore, I think if there's to be a hope for a socialist idea, you have to have some other force that can join with this working class force. And I think that what is now emerging in the United States, but also in all the advanced countries of the world, is this huge college-educated constituency called into being by the sophistication of modern technology, an absolute requirement for modern production, so that you now have in the United States between 40% and 50% of the available generation going to college. In the 70s, it's going to be over 50%. Therefore, you can no longer talk of college students as they used to, as a small group who could be ignored. Now they are become a mass force, as the Kennedy and McCarthy campaigns in 68 and the moratorium in 69 and 70 have demonstrated. And I think one of the significant things was contained in this Fortune poll, which was taken in October of 1968. And as of October 1968, Fortune magazine computed that 40% of the 8 million Americans between 18 and 24 who were either in college or had been there, 40% of them, that's over 3 million young people, no longer looked upon the money as the crucial thing in determining the career they were going to choose and the life they wanted to live. That is to say, I think it's an irony that one of the consequences of capitalist affluence is to produce not among the children of the prisoners of starvation, but rather among the children of the well-off, because that's where these idealistic young come from, to produce a social conscience. In my article, I suggested in sort of cold economic terms, and I think it's true, that perhaps there is a declining marginal utility to money. That is to say, as a society gets richer and richer and richer,
money means less and less.
Money means less and less and less. For Jack Kennedy to have gone out and made another million, or Robert Kennedy to have done that, would have been the height of vulgarity. Once having being the children of a millionaire, then you, so to speak, the only way you can turn to are social problems, political achievement. And I think that that Kennedy phenomenon is now beginning to happen with many, many of the children of the affluent, of people less wealthy than the Kennedys, but nevertheless very well off.
Where's the New Left fit into this, in your eyes? Is the New Left following any of these rules? Is the New Left going to isolate itself from the working class? Is the New Left rapidly destroy what gains it has made?
Well, I think the problem is that there are several New Lefts, in the 1969-70 school year, the essential breakup of the old SDS, because it is now gone, has revealed that very clearly. I think that the tendencies in SDS towards a sectarianism, a kind of old-fashioned Marxism, Leninism, Stalinism. I never thought I would see Stalin heroized in, of all places, the United States. That tendency, the violence engaged in by the Weathermen, I think will help to drive the society to the right. However, at the same time, I think that the impulse which led to the emergence of SDS as a mass student organization was a very healthy one. And that there are literally thousands and tens of thousands of students who were members, who participated in a demonstration, who marched here or there, who are the very best of their generation. And what my hope is that the adult society can, with movements like the Kennedy and McCarthy campaigns, with activities like the moratorium, help these young people to find a way to express their excellent discontent, not on the fringe of the society with dotting ideological I's and crossing ideological T's, but in the mainstream of the society. And indeed, in my article, I feel that the hope for socialism, certainly in Europe, where it needs a shot in the arm because it's become really integrated into a welfare state status quo, in Europe and also here, is if you can bring together the protesters who are the result of affluence, the New Left generation, with the protesters who are the result of scarcity, that is to say, the labor movement, which still represents people who have to struggle to make the payments on the car at best, and a lot of them don't have cars, really have to struggle to make their daily bread. And I think that if these two groups could come together,
Is there going to be a linkage with the Internationale and this? Do you foresee this happening? Or is the Internationale also a vestige of another time?
No, I think the Socialist International, wisely, is not a general staff of the world revolution. It's never had that pretense. The communists had that pretense, and as they discovered last year at their Moscow summit meeting, it's rather difficult for a centralized bureaucracy to direct movements all over the world. I think the function of the Socialist International is very much the role it played last summer when I was in England, that of bringing people together for a non-dogmatic discussion of problems. And one of the things that impressed me very much at the International, and I mentioned it in the article, is that these parties, although they are stuck in the status quo, are aware of it, they're unhappy about it, and they're looking for a way out. That makes me hopeful.
Thank you very much, Michael Harrington. I am Denny Crimmins, the social publisher of Harper's Magazine, and this has been At Issue.